Welcome to The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. If you have not read the poetry of Portland's Matthew Dickman or haven't heard him speak, do yourself a favor and stay tuned. We are going to begin this program with our top story. Seattle's Mayor Jenny Durkan is not ready to support the proposed employee head tax.
It is too early to say what's the right amount, how long should it go, but I think what is on the table right now, we have seen, doesn't meet the requirements that I have as mayor.
This is the proposal for a per-employee tax on the city's highest-grossing businesses. The money would pay for low-income housing and services for homeless people. Amazon would be the number one payer of this tax, and they are so opposed to it that they've halted construction on a new tower in downtown Seattle and put the pause on another project as well. Also opposed to the head tax, Starbucks, Alaska Airlines, Dick's Drive-In. In favor of the tax, a majority on the Seattle City Council. They say the $75 million a year it would raise would help make Seattle a place where low-income people and homeless people can get what they need. The City Council is scheduled to vote on this on Monday, so we're here to help you figure this out. We're taking your calls right now, 206-543-5869, 206-543-5869. If you're in Seattle, do you want your city councilor to vote yes or no on this employee head tax, and why? If you're outside Seattle, how do you view this tax? Is this liberals being wacky? Is this Seattle having to bear the burden for a regional crisis? Are you just undecided with questions? We're taking your calls, 206-543-5869, 543-5869. So give us a call. We begin with KUOW reporter Amy Radel. Thanks for coming in, Amy.
Yeah, hi.
When I say this tax would pay for low-income housing and homeless services, could you say a little more? What do we mean?
I think the actual objectives are still being talked about as they try to bring on support from even more members of the Seattle City Council. But right now, 75%, by far most of the funding, is going to build mixed-income rental housing, affordable housing for people who need that. And then on the homeless services side, they're talking about things like portable bathrooms, trash removal, a mobile medical van, tiny houses. And there's also going to be a raise for the people who work with the homeless, because they say that right now people are not paid enough and there's such high turnover that that's affecting the ability to deliver services. So the raise for them is included too.
Seattle's had a head tax before. How'd that work out? Tell us the story.
It was for a few years, about a decade ago, and then they repealed it during the recession. So it was a tax businesses paid. In that case, it went for transportation. The reason it really matters now is we know Seattle basically has the legal authority to assess this tax. Unlike the income tax and things that have gone to court, that part would be more straightforward if this happens.
And that was a smaller head tax in that case, 2006 or whatever it was, right?
Yeah.
This would be $500 roughly per employee per year. The income would be at least $20 million a year for the city of Seattle.
$75
million. $75 million a year. Sorry about it. This is for businesses who gross at least $20 million a year. That's
right.
Why you're here, Amy.
Yep.
Thank you. Bringing in about $75 million per year. That's the plan. Now, Mayor Durkan could influence the tax. She could veto this tax. And Amy, she said yesterday it does not meet her requirements. What does that mean?
Well, she's mentioned repeatedly wanting to find a compromise with business at the table. It's not really clear if those conversations are happening or if that's possible. But she has mentioned very concrete things that she'd like to see that seem appealing to some of the city council members who are on the fence about this as well. Things like it could be sunsetted and subject to renewal. She wants to know.
Sunsetted meaning it make it temporary and then
yes.
Take another look.
Yeah, exactly. And also kind of what would the accountability be? Who would evaluate this? And how would we look at the economic impacts for people who are concerned about the effects on local jobs?
Okay, well, that's a good point to bring in a city council member, Lorena Gonzalez. Council member, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, as we just heard, Mayor Durkan has some ideas. For example, make this a temporary tax, a sunset provision. What do you think of that? By the way, you're a supporter of this tax so far.
I am one of the prime sponsors
yeah.
of the legislation. I was one of the co-chairs of the Progressive Revenue Task Force that convened in the first quarter of this year. I think I have been able to have multiple conversations with Mayor Durkan over the last several weeks on this issue. I really appreciate her willingness to continue to talk to me and some of my colleagues around her specific concerns. And I think, we share some of the same priorities in terms of some potential changes to the underlying ordinance. And certainly one of the things that I mentioned during yesterday's committee hearing is a proposal around an affirmative renewal requirement of these of the tax. So it would be in place for 5 years. At the end of 5 years, there would be an evaluation based on a set number of criteria that would be considered by the city council that would contribute to a decision as to whether or not to renew it, and if it is renewed, for how much.
Okay, so you're okay with that so-called sunset provision idea, 5-year tax, and then you reassess. What about the idea of just shrinking the tax, making it bring in less money or hit fewer companies?
Yeah, no, I think if it hits fewer companies, then we're talking about raising less money. And the reality is that we just saw an independent report released just yesterday from McKinsey talking about how the need to address homelessness throughout King County is actually somewhere in the neighborhood of $410 million a year. And we know that about 75% of King County's unsheltered population is right here in the city of Seattle. So I think that there is a reality here of the fact that that $75 million is a good down deposit on addressing these issues and could be representative of the city of Seattle's role and responsibility in the regional approach that we keep hearing about.
Councilmember Lorena Gonzalez, here is your colleague on the council, Bruce Harrell, sounding skeptical that the city deserves this new tax money.
I also don't think we've convinced the public that we are spending our money wisely in terms of solving the problem of homelessness.
What do you say to that?
You know, I think I share Council President Harrell's sentiment and the public sentiment that we can do better in this area. And the reality is that we have taken measurable steps on the City Council and under the former mayoral administration to begin doing that. So last budget, we passed a law that requires specific performance requirements for our investments in this area. And we also have a new competitive grant-making process at the city that was unveiled in 2018 and will continue through 2019 and beyond. And so we have moved in a direction of requiring performance measures and accountability and outcomes, which is something that the city had not been doing prior to 2017. And in 2017, we saw that our investments, which were at about $53 million in the area of homelessness, actually has resulted in approximately 5,000 people being moved from shelters and living on the street to permanent housing.
To ask you about exemptions to the tax. Yesterday in the chambers, there was some discussion of nonprofits and also that nonprofits are currently exempted, but also that life science businesses might be exempted. I just wondered who meets the criteria for the $20 million in revenue might be exempted from paying the tax.
Well, that's all proprietary information, so our Finance and Administrative Services doesn't share with us the specific types of companies who fall into the category of $20 million or greater without the exemption. We have heard from some folks within that life sciences and research community who have identified that they might potentially be included in that $20 million threshold or above. So those are folks like the Seattle Cancer Care Alliance and the Fred Hutch Research Center, and we are continuing to have conversations with them about the impact and the potential of an exemption.
Councilmember Lorena Gonzalez, we were just talking about whether the city has shown that it can spend the money wisely that it already has. And we have a call along those lines. Again, we're taking calls 206-543-5869, 543-5869. Nigel in West Seattle, do you have a question or a comment for Councilmember Gonzalez?
Hi, Councilmember Gonzalez. So, yes, I do. I'm interfacing with a lot of Amazon employees right now. And I also work with the homeless. And there's a belief amongst the Amazon employees, people that have actually been here a while, that there's a lack of accountability and trust with the Seattle City Council and how they disperse these funds that are collected through various taxes. That's the appearance thereof. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But in a wider field, if you talk to people in Seattle, I also am a part-time Uber driver, and this is a topic of conversation right now. And the one thing that keeps coming back is that people don't trust the city council to disperse the funds the way they said. Somebody mentioned that in 2015, the property taxes were raised specifically to help the homeless, but the money didn't quite get there as promised or as was said. The other piece that I want to quickly just bring up is, as a retired mental health professional, you have to, it is foolish and short-sighted to provide funds for the homeless or for affordable housing if you're not providing services for mental health and substance abuse.
Okay,
you're just putting people into housing who can't manage their day-to-day life, and then you've got a mess.
Councilmember Gonzalez, yes, thank you, Nigel. Councilmember, what do you say? Nigel's concerned that on a couple of fronts that the city has not spent the money it's already taken in well enough, and he questions the efficacy of the way the plan is.
Well, I think I would have a couple of responses. One is that, as I just mentioned, our 2017 investments have shown really positive results. The issue is around prevention, and the reality is that we last year experienced 30,000 new individuals entering into homelessness because of the tremendous amount of growth that our city is experiencing. And the McKinsey report that came out yesterday specifically talks about how 96% of the people who are going into homelessness are doing so because they can no longer afford the rent. And so as the city continues to grow, as we continue to have this economic boom, it is directly contributing to the chronic lack of affordable housing, not just in the city of Seattle, but across King County. So the spending plan that we have crafted related to this particular tax squarely focuses on what we as Seattleites are seeing on the street every single day.
Thank you. I have one follow-up for Nigel. You still there, Nigel? So you said that the city doesn't seem to have spent the money it already has well enough. So I'd like, what is one benchmark? What's one change that you would look at and say, yes, thank you, you did it. Seattle, you have done the thing I want that makes me say you now deserve this extra tax money. Give us one example, please.
Well, what I said in my original thing was that there's the appearance of.
Yes. So, yes.
But you hear a lot of people talking about that. And as I said, I don't know whether that's true. But what the city council could do is to really take some time and explain to the public where the money has gone and how it's gone and what has happened.
Okay.
That's not out in the public enough. But the other one other quick follow-up. 90% of the people who are homeless in this city, just like they are across, I work in the UK with a charity, the homeless there, it's the same there, that 90% of the homeless population in this King County, in Seattle, have a substance abuse and or mental health issue that is largely left untreated because this state and the federal government and the city about 15 years ago, all the public funds for those treatment of those conditions dried up.
Okay, Nigel, thank you for that. Yes, thank you for the questions and the comments. We have City Council Member Lorena Gonzalez. We have KOW reporter Amy Radel. We're going to take a quick break. Before that, any other reaction, Amy, to what you've heard so far? You're one of our reporters on this, head tax.
Actually, Councilmember Gonzalez, if you just wanted to say where people can find the study you referenced showing the number of people who were, who did find housing or did leave homelessness, I thought that might be helpful.
Well, I think the Seattle Times reported on it yesterday. Vianna Davila posted a report. We are still trying to get our hands on the full report, but as soon as we have that, we will see how we can make that publicly available.
And is it true, council member, that what Nigel said, that there's the public doesn't have a way to know how the city has already spent the money it's taken in for affordable housing and homelessness? Or can they go to the city's website or something and see what's been done with that money? He wanted to know.
Yeah, there's two separate issues here. For our affordable housing investments, those are through our Office of Housing, and they do have performance measures and metrics available on their website related to our affordable housing levy that passed in 2016, and those numbers are available. Our Human Services Department, that's an area where that department and we as a city can do a better job telling our story of how we are impacting people's lives. One of the things that I have done is asked for a full audit of all of our human services investments and contracting, and we're hoping to have results on that by the end of the year or early next year.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of people would like that information. And
we have a
city council vote coming up on Monday is how it's scheduled. We're going to take a brief break and come right back. Again, if you have a question, input, it's 206-543-5869, 543-5869. We'll be right back. On KUOW's The Record, we're discussing Seattle's proposed per-employee and employee hours tax, better known as the head tax, on Seattle's highest grossing businesses. We have KUOW reporter Amy Radle here. We have KUOW Councilmember Lorena Gonzalez. Councilor, your colleague Mike O'Brien got physically escorted out of an after party. We've seen some raucous city council hearings. Is this just the public being passionate and involved, or do you think that Seattle's past some line where we've become too angry and uncivil about this issue of head taxes and homelessness?
You know, I was really disappointed to hear about Councilmember O'Brien's treatment at that event. And I like to believe that we are a city that can engage in civic discourse, and that we allow each other the space and the grace to disagree with each other in a respectful manner. And I was really disappointed to hear that that incident occurred. And
well, what about the loud city council hearings? I mean, is that, you hear Great Britain, they're rah, 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 they have their raucous, right? So is it so bad for people to say, yeah, I'm lifting my voice, I'm frustrated?
You know, I get it. People are very impassioned about the issues that they care about. And I think it is fair to say that in the city of Seattle, we all agree that homelessness is the top issue and should continue to be the top priority for the city of Seattle.
Okay.
We disagree as to how to solve for that particular issue. And people have a lot of opinions about whether or not we should take a law and order approach, or whether we should skew towards complete compassion. And I think that the city council's job and the city's job as a whole is to find the balance between between both of those spectrums.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's part of democracy for folks to express their opinions. They have the right to do that. And my hope is that we can move in a direction where we can do that in a way that still respects each other's integrity, and it's unnecessary to say that we are that a person is morally corrupt just because they don't agree with you.
And to be fair, people also can define compassion differently from one another.
Absolutely.
Speaking of opinion, we have a phone call from, is it Rossi in West Seattle?
Yes, hi there.
Hi, you're on with Councilmember Gonzalez.
First of all, I want to thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I have a question. Where is the marijuana tax going to? Number one. Number two, if you guys want to talk about affordable housing, stop raising the property taxes. As a landlord, my property tax this year went up 45%. Who do they think is going to pay for that? I have no choice but to raise my rent and make it higher so the tenant is going to feel priced out.
Okay, thank you for that, Rossi. We're separating marijuana for a moment. Council member, that these tax questions are linked, right? They're not just, it's not just a head tax. It's people react to all the taxes they pay. Is there something you want to say to Seattleites who are frustrated about the high level of property tax in this town?
You know, I'm a property owner myself and have also received my property tax bill this year. There's a couple of things that I will say here. One is that we know that the city of Seattle is in a position where, as a city, we don't have a lot of tools available to us because of actions that the Washington State Legislature has taken and that the citizens have taken to restrict and prohibit municipalities from being much more creative around our tax structure and how we can generate revenue to meet the needs of a growing city like Seattle.
Yeah, we don't have an income tax, and we're paying a lot of property taxes for reasons of funding, education, and other things.
Right, and those are things that the city council does not have authority over. We did not legislate tax proposals around McCleary to fund education, but we are dealing within that system. So I wanted to just make sure that that was clear. But on top of that, you know, I think that the reason why it was important for us to put this proposal forward is because we believe that this proposal is a common sense way to address homelessness and the need for more deeply affordable housing in Seattle, rather than creating a new property or sales tax that will hurt homeowners, renters, and consumers. And so instead of doing that, we're asking some of the city's largest corporations to chip in, just like we have as individuals, to help us address our homelessness crisis.
You're listening to KUOW Seattle, and we have been discussing the tax, the proposed employee head tax. We have a full city council vote expected on Monday. And what do you expect, council member? Do you think this vote is going to pass on Monday, despite all the objections from Amazon and others?
You know, I think that we are, my last count is that we have at least five council members who have signaled their support. We have four co-sponsors on this legislation and another who has indicated that she will support the base legislation. I think the reality is can we find a path over the next several days that allows other council members to join us in voting yes on this proposal? And I want to continue to have conversations with the mayor around her specific concerns, including on the spending side. And I think that we are continuing to get more information and more data, but we are certainly on track to put this in front of the full council this Monday.
And I just wondered, kind of, you know, pragmatically, like, basically, what are you doing with the rest of the day today? Who are you talking to? And also, you mentioned yesterday possibly bringing forth a whole new version of the legislation. And when would you expect to do that, if I understood right?
So we have given our colleagues a deadline of noon to get all of their amendments in. I'm in here sitting with you all, so I'm hoping that folks have complied with that deadline, and we hope to be able to circulate proposed amendments and revisions to the base ordinance as soon as we can, certainly before the close of business. And we want to make those publicly available as well so that folks who are impacted and who could be benefited from these investments have a full range of information. You know, throughout the rest of the day, I will be in and out of meetings with my colleagues on the floor. I hope to be able to and do intend to meet with the mayor later this afternoon to have another conversation about how we can find consensus around this to make sure that all interests or as many of the interests that we can meet are met.
Seattle City Council Member Lorena Gonzalez, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Again, city council vote is planned on Monday. Any final remarks, reactions, things we should look for, Amy Radel?
We'll just be back in the committee tomorrow, so it'll be interesting to see if they are able to bring any of the four remaining council members on board, and then, right, looking ahead to Monday.
We'll continue to follow the debate over a proposed employee head tax in Seattle and the reaction to it from Amazon, most notably, from many other businesses, from you if you are a Seattle resident. In fact, people all around Seattle weighing in on this discussion. It's The Record on KUOW, back with Portland poet Matthew Dickman in just a moment. It's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. I never met Caleb. I do wonder if it had to turn out this way. The Portland poet Matthew Dickman writes about Caleb in his new collection called Wonderland. When we first meet him, he's just a little boy.
Caleb is standing in his front yard, hitting a stick against a tree. In 3 months, he will be in the fifth grade. He's thinking about He-Man and She-Ra, about Castle Grayskull. Inside the house, his dad is screaming at his mom. Now Caleb's throwing the stick in the air and imagining it's a sword on fire that only he can catch. When his dad leaves, Caleb will go into the house and find his mom in the weird dark of his parents' bedroom, where he will kiss her busted lip, crawl onto the bed and hold her, his arms just beneath her ribs. Eventually, he will go back out into the yard, pick up the once flaming sword, and wait.
Do you know what Caleb is waiting for?
His father. Yeah. That was something a lot of boys growing up in my neighborhood were waiting for, was their father. Waiting, I think, in different ways. Sometimes waiting with anxiety because they never knew what was going to happen when their father came home. And others waiting for their father out of a desperation of need and love. So some waiting for their father with a sense of dread and protection, and others just waiting to be held.
What neighborhood was this?
This was a neighborhood called Lentz in Portland, Oregon, which is considered deep southeast Portland. I lived off and around 82nd and Foster.
Was there something special to you about the Lentz neighborhood that these kids were waiting for their fathers in this way? Could this have been anywhere?
This could be anywhere. I mean, this could be, and it is. I mean, it's so many neighborhoods. This is the 80s, and it's a neighborhood of, you know, low middle class, poor, predominantly at that time, white neighborhood. There were not a lot of examples of fatherhood, you know, that you might think of in a positive way in that neighborhood. A lot of single moms, a lot of dads in and out of prison, definitely in and out of bars, and a kind of, I think, unintentional freedom for the kids. Actually, when I think back about my childhood and how much we roamed around the neighborhood, and how late at night we roamed around the neighborhood, and the fact that we were only 10 or 11 years old, to me now, especially as a father, seems, you know, insane to me in some way.
You say that your neighborhood taught a bad class about masculinity. What do you mean by that?
I feel like there was a kind of contract about masculinity and a negative contract. What the neighborhood taught about masculinity was that you did not share any of your feelings with anybody. You didn't really even show up for anybody except for yourself and maybe your friends. It also taught you that the only way to solve a problem was through either ignoring that problem and leaving, as so many fathers did, or by fighting. You know, I think it taught young boys, there was also this like schism between how you were supposed to think about, let's say, like your mother, and then how you treated and thought about like girls in the neighborhood. There was a real difference there. And part of that was just watching the examples given by older brothers and fathers who I think essentially were really injured people. They were injured sometimes just through addiction, heroin, alcohol. They were injured by poverty, and they were injured by a sort of expectation, I think, of the self that never came to fruition.
What expectation is that?
I think to be successful in some way, whether that's like big and tough or enough money or, you know, enough girlfriends, the right car. I mean, a car at all, you know, in the neighborhood. So these kind of strange expectations that are handed down to the men in my neighborhood.
How about you, Matthew? What were you learning in this masculinity class?
I was lucky because I had extra credit at home, which is to say that I had a single mom who was fierce and tough, did not allow certain behaviors in the household. We weren't allowed to fight in the household. She made sure that we knew how strong women were. I could see it just by looking at her. I could see it in the way my little sister was growing up. But outside of the house, what I watched were friends of mine who I would, knew 4 or 5 years old on, turning from these really great creative kids who eventually, not all of them, but a lot of them, start walking in the same path as their older brothers or their father. And some of those paths were addiction, as I'd mentioned. Others were gangs, watching friends and, the older siblings of friends join gangs like the East Side White Pride.
Yeah, you have a poem. Was it for Ian Sullivan? Was that his name?
Sullivan,
when he joined
yeah.
the East Side White Pride.
Yeah.
Would you read that one for us?
Sure. For Ian Sullivan, upon joining the East Side White Pride, even now, even now, even now, no one can say that you were never a child. What our neighborhood lacked in compassion, it made up for in baseball, stomp, bats, and chain link fences, Asian mini marts, and your parents' rage swelling inside your chest, stomp, like someone pumping up a basketball, like someone taking a long drag off a cigarette. Now, when you get dressed, stomp for battle. People cross the street when they see you like you were black, like you weren't afraid of anything, like there was nothing you wouldn't do, but you are afraid, stomp, of everything, of everything, of everything.
This is poet Matthew Dickman, and his new collection is called Wonderland. We started off talking about the bad class in masculinity that your neighborhood taught. How did race come into it in your neighborhood?
Well, race, first of all, showed up in the neighborhood just out of the fact that it was a predominantly white neighborhood. And racism and bigotry and really active racism in the form of either the East Side White Pride or in the form of the stories about race that the parents were telling children in the neighborhood seemed to always be there in my memory. Of course, that's not true. But by the time I showed up in the neighborhood, it was. I think one of the things that I feel is true about that neighborhood in that time is that there was a great lie about race being told. And that lie was that even if your mom shoots heroin and sleeps with the neighbors, even if your dad, shows up drunk at your eighth grade graduation or comes home every other night and beats you or beats your mom, even if you're on food stamps, even if you're getting blocks of government cheese, none of it matters because you're still white. You're still, something that's supposed to be great. It was like a consolation prize for poverty in a way that I feel like people in the neighborhood really attached themselves to.
What do you mean when you said even now no one can say that you were never a child?
I was thinking about when people do awful things, or when we look out from our lives and we see like a school shooter, or we see a skinhead who I knew when I was a kid. The terrifying thing is not that these people are other, not that these people are monsters. We sort of put that on people like that because we immediately want to separate from them. That's not me. That person's crazy. That person's a monster. And I think about like Dr. Maya Angelou, she said something like, "Yeah, I'm a human being, therefore nothing human is alien to me." You can't say, like, "That could never be me," or "I could never do that." And she makes a correction. She says, "Well, that's wrong. You can say, I endeavor never to do that. I endeavor not to have those feelings. I endeavor not to take actions like that," which is all to say that I think we are not going to get at the core of issues around violence and race in neighborhoods like the neighborhood I grew up in, as long as we are sort of separating these people out by calling them monsters or not thinking about their childhood, where they came from, what, not as excuses, but as a whole sort of understanding.
What happens when that person is not seen as a monster? Do you have a story of what happens when that goes on?
You just reminded me of this very strange incident. My brother and I, and a friend of ours, we must have been like 12 or 13 years old. We are walking through a park near our house, and there were a couple skinheads sitting on a picnic table and a bench. Since there are three of us and there are two of them, I wasn't like too worried. They often jumped on people when they outnumbered them. We're walking through this park, and we were walking with a friend of ours who was kind of a f***ed up person. He was a person who experienced a lot of trauma in his household. And I think there was some meanness in him as a child. We were walking along, and there was a cat there. And this friend of ours just ran up and kicked the cat, like, up into the air. And the skinheads saw that happen. And they came running over and beat down this friend of ours who had kicked the cat. My brother and I just sort of stood there. I mean, I stood there still in shock that he had kicked the cat. And then when I saw what was happening to him, I felt, well, that's right. I felt like, well, that's what I felt at 12 or 13.
Like, this is how it should go down.
Like, this is how it should go down, right? You kicked a cat for no reason up in the air. Like, you kind of deserve this in some way.
These skinheads are the good guys in this scenario for a moment.
For a moment, yeah. I think that we're also talking about the idea maybe of normalcy. So, of course, anyone who you see at a certain point who's doing things that you disagree with, doing things that are violent and inhumane, all of them have had experience after experience of doing humane things. And I mean, unless we're talking about like true, sociopathic people who were sick from an early age, but we're not talking about sociopathic people, not in that way. And I'm not talking about people who are insane. So just by them living this long that they've had moments of encounter of grace and empathy. Their whole lives have not been always this one thing that they are at this point. I think also as children, all these experiences just are normal because they're part of life. One of the great powers that children have, especially in neighborhoods like this, experiencing the things that they would experience in this neighborhood, is a scary power. And that's a power, I believe, of compartmentalization. When I think back to experiences that I had in the neighborhood that immediately afterwards just walked to the corner store to buy JoJo's and a Dr. Pepper, if that thing had happened to me now as a 42-year-old, I wouldn't be able to just walk down the street to Trader Joe's and get a smoothie. I would want to go directly home, lie on the bed and like not leave the house for a couple days and talk to friends and process it and be freaked out. But as a kid, you just keep rolling along because you have to in some ways.
Were you monstrous?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I think in different ways I was. There was a time in seventh grade when for the first part of the year, a friend of mine and I had been constantly cornered and picked on or beat up by this other like much bigger kid than we were and a couple of his friends. And something happened to him one weekend and he was out of school for about a week. He came back and he had a, let's see, he was on crutches and he had a cast on one leg and then like a wrap around the ankle on the other. And my friend and I had like skipped class and we were like roaming around this giant three-story school and we found him alone in the hallway. And so we took his crutches away from him and he fell over and we just beat him with the crutches and then threw them down the stairwell to the bottom. We were on the third floor, down the stairwell to the bottom floor, and then just went to class.
I'm sure it hurt him. What did it do to you?
I think it probably made me feel good. You know, I think it felt probably at that time like well-earned revenge. And it also just felt very normal, like this is something you were supposed to do.
So are you going to tell your now one-year-old boy, never take revenge? You're going to you're going to teach a class yourself here pretty soon.
Yeah, well, I'm already starting. So I have an 11-year-old boy.
Oh.
And now 1-year-old boy. And it's something that I've been thinking about. It's something that I thought about when I was writing this book, Wonderland, thinking about boys and boyhood and thinking about, you know, bravado and all these things and how I was going to try and raise them in a way where they were stronger than both myself and my friends in the neighborhood when I was growing up. I'm still working that out.
Well, we started out meeting Caleb,
yeah,
who we follow him through your book, your collection, Wonderland, a collection of poems. And Caleb is, we see after that, after he's in his yard pretending that falling stick is a flaming sword and waiting for his father, we see him bullying, if you want to call it that, mm-hmm, a dog and a boy. And would you read the poem from the last Wonderland poem from when we leave Caleb?
Yeah. So at this point, I think we've seen him in 5 iterations, sort of growing up. The one right before this is him as a, you know, young kid giving himself a tattoo of a swastika.
With a needle and ink and a towel.
Yeah, doing kind of poke and stick in his garage, sitting on a skateboard. That poem that precedes this one, I think of as sort of the bridge into what becomes, you know, his new family and his new life. Wonderland. Caleb is marching with his new friends, their shaved heads like tongues of fire, up 82nd Avenue, the cars honking at them like they were vets just home from the war. He must feel so safe in his skin. He must feel like he belongs. With each step, each time he raises his arm in the air at that angle we all know, a part of him transforms. A part of him fades, and in its place is something more vulnerable than a worm. He is swinging a metal pipe in a hand that looks like an insect's pincer. His face looks like a piece of fruit covered in flies. Every time he takes a step, his childhood evaporates. Branches begin to crawl out of his head, rise up like antlers.
Why antlers?
I was thinking about that very thing, kind of that we were talking about earlier, about a way for us to deal with but not understand people like Caleb or people who go in and shoot up a school is to sort of deny them their humanity, right?
Mm-hmm.
It saves us. It essentially protects us. But in this final poem about Caleb, he's now full in. He's marching with these other skinheads. And that is, to me, a kind of a monstrous transformation. He's still a person, but I was trying to imagine what he looked like to maybe someone who didn't grow up in that neighborhood, too. I know this subject and these people for, you know, some of your listeners will be kind of shocking. I tried to look through a lens of someone who hadn't grown up seeing these guys and just how monstrous and strange and transformed Caleb would look as a full-blown neo-Nazi. And so I just imagined these different body parts changing. And antlers are something that, you know, assholes go out and shoot animals for big antlers because they make themselves feel big. So antlers are a sort of false bravado, I feel like. And so I wanted that to be a kind of final image. And antlers are also dangerous. The fact is he's become a dangerous, dangerous person.
He's dangerous now.
Yeah.
Is Caleb safe in his skin, or is he more vulnerable than a worm, or both?
I think his humanity becomes more vulnerable than a worm. And at that time, in my neighborhood, at that particular time, he had to have felt really safe in his skin. I think he always probably felt safe. I mean, every white person in my neighborhood was born into just the privilege of that, you know. But I think when I say safe in his skin at that point, it's also like safe, a safety from any of the vulnerabilities of life, right? Any of his own insecurities, anything that makes him, that would make him humane, he gets to block out through his identity as a neo-Nazi and as a skinhead.
You're telling these stories in this poetry collection. Are you hoping to save the next Caleb? What are you hoping to do telling their stories?
I don't think books can save people's lives. I do think they can influence them and help radically change them. I found poetry in high school, as a freshman in high school. And when I stumbled upon it, the first poet I ever read that was not a dead white person was Anne Sexton. And then after finding Anne Sexton, I read Lucille Clifton. And something both these poets were doing where they were writing about real things going on in their lives in these ways that was really moving to me. So I started doing the same privately. I never announced it. I never would walk through the neighborhood and say, I'm writing poetry, because I, you know, didn't want to walk through the neighborhood and beg to get beat up.
Good move.
Yeah. I know that there is a power in poetry to engage in one's empathy and humanity. And I think one of the ways I know I'm going to raise these two boys of mine is to make sure that poetry is in their lives. I know for a fact that the type of boys that I grew up with, they didn't have any form of art in their lives.
Caleb is into He-Man and She-Ra.
Yeah, yeah. There's cartoons and things like that. But and there is imagination. You know, you don't have a childhood without it. But it's not supported. And children in neighborhoods like the one I grew up in are asked to abandon imagination and abandon childhood at a young age. Something that the arts does is it engages in that inner child of yours. It engages in that sense of wonderment. And it engages in that sense of wonderment where you're looking out to something you don't know or understand, but you are willing to open your arms to it, to witness it, right? And not to automatically deny it. And I think it's important for young people, and I think it's really, really important for young boys to be given access to things that are vulnerable. And I think poetry is vulnerable. I think writing in general is vulnerable. And so if I were to leave anyone with any thought in their head after reading Wonderland, it's just the importance of vulnerability in the world.
Well, Matthew Dickman, the collection is Wonderland. Thanks for telling your stories and being vulnerable. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
That's our show for today. Thanks for listening. The record's produced by Amina Al-Sadi, Allison Bruzek, Ajua Jimabrenpong, Jason Pagano, social media producer Bree Ripley. Tomorrow we catch you up on what happened this week. It's the Week in Review with John Keister, Joni Balter, David Goldstein. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.